Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CJSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
Welcome to this week's edition of Latin Waves. On the first part of the show, we speak to Aura Bogado. She's a freelance writer and journalist. Bogado was a founding member of the 33 and a Third Books Collective in Echo Park and worked with Pacifica Radio for 6 years. She speaks about the continued fallout of immigration bill SB 1070 in Arizona and how even in its current scaled-back version, Arizona's SB 1070 and the Obama administration's response to it has already given us an indication of the schizophrenic and flawed approach the federal government will likely take once it finally moves forward on comprehensive immigration reform. In the last part of the show, we speak to Dr. Maria Paez Victor, who's a Venezuelan-born sociologist and consultant who has taught sociology of health and medicine at the University of Toronto. She's been involved for a number of years with the Louis Real Bolivarian Circle and is a close colleague of Hands Off Venezuela. She speaks about the continued U.S. aggression and military buildup in the region, which threatens the Bolivarian Revolution. Stay tuned.
My guest, Aura Bogado, will be talking to us a little bit about the proposed legislation and how is this creating division within the state of Arizona. Thank you for joining us, Aura.
It's great to be here, Sylvia.
Now, many people in Latin America migrate to the U.S., particularly people from Mexico, Central America. And a lot of the root causes of why people are forced to leave their countries are never really contextualized or talked about in society. We usually talk in terms of laws, who's abiding the law and who's breaking the law. So when we create laws that don't take into account the contextual historical reality of exploitation and expropriation of land, we end up with laws that are one-sided. Talk a little bit about this law, SB 1070, that is now being put on hold but still very much being advocated for in the state of Arizona.
It actually hasn't fully been put on hold. Parts of it have been temporarily put on hold, but a lot of parts of it are still being fully enforced throughout Arizona. Parts of it including the fact that if I drive somebody who's an undocumented immigrant, for example, I can be criminalized for that act because it can be seen now under the law as similar to aiding and abetting that person. It also bars cities, entire cities, from making what's called sanctuary cities, which sanctuary cities have historically in the United States protected the rights of people regardless of their immigration status based on human rights framework. And under the law, people, everyday people, are now able to sue cities that they feel are not enforcing federal immigration law. This is really sort of an unprecedented type of move that we've seen in terms of state legislation in the United States.
I guess it's salient to speak about who are the architects of this law and why now, why at this time?
Yeah, well, Russell Pierce, he's a senior senator from the city of Mesa, Arizona, has crafted and supported some of the most sensational anti-immigrant laws in that state. He's supported, of course, by fellow legislators and everyday Arizonans who seem to believe that their world will somehow be made better by criminalizing brown bodies. Nationwide in the U.S., we've seen that the law is supported here by more than half of the population. But taking into account what you were talking about in terms of the historical roots of laws, I think that it is important to look at the historical root of this law, SB 1070. This concept of illegality, that is the suspected criminality of one's entire being, is really a first world phenomenon. In most of the global south, for example, it is possible to have a social sense of not belonging culturally in a certain nation because one is there as an immigrant, but the idea that the letter of the law would deem a human being as illegal is virtually unheard of. Deportation in the third world is seen as a drastic measure and would only be considered when a serious crime is committed. And that's not to say, for example, that an indigenous Quechua woman from Peru isn't going to face formidable racism when she chooses to go to work in Buenos Aires, Argentina, for example. But she's not going to be hunted down by local or federal authorities. Her political subjectivity, if you will, is not that of an illegal alien. She's still a human being, and she's subject to human rights. In the United States, however, we find the practice of criminalizing people based on their suspected immigration status, which is always based on certain racial and ethnic categories, and we somehow find that here to be natural. Historically, the U.S. has used immigration to manufacture and to reinforce these concepts about the nation and its territory through borders. It's about control. Just yesterday, President Obama signed a $600 million border enforcement bill, and that's about control as well. And it should be seen as keeping in step historically with federal immigration law, which seeks to reinforce the legitimacy of the state. This is a bill, of course, which President Obama signed yesterday, which was unanimously approved in both the Senate and the House in special session. Several years ago, that the federal government began signing contracts, memorandums of understanding, MOUs, with local law enforcement departments to enforce federal immigration law. These MOUs are known as 287G, and Maricopa County, which is Arizona's largest county, has long practiced a de facto form of SB 1070 for several years now through 287G. Sheriff Sorpayo has been doing locally in Arizona, in Phoenix, Arizona, what Arizona and many other states are now trying to do statewide. His original 287G was with the Bush administration. The Obama administration renewed it recently, although it supposedly rescinded his department's ability to enforce federal law on the street and limited only to being able to enforce it in jails. But nevertheless, we see this collaboration between local law enforcement and federal law enforcement well before this bill was enforced in Arizona. So part of the answer to your question, who are the architects of this law? And it's really the United States of America, keeping in historic step with what it's been doing. I believe the second part of your question was why this is happening now. And I believe it's happening now because the state is in crisis, because everyday people are realizing that the state is falling apart, that its economic policies don't stand up. And at a time when masses of people are deeply disappointed and are having a hard time making ends meet, the best thing a state can do is to reinforce this illusion that everyday folks are somehow still better here than anywhere else in the world. The state legitimizes itself by legitimizing its citizens against so-called illegal aliens. As long as illegal aliens are the problem, they can be blamed for supposedly taking jobs away from U.S. Americans. And most of us don't have to worry about these root causes. We don't need to worry about big bank bailouts and the way in which big business is rewarded. Instead, we can just blame a group of brown people.
The other salient point you make is by creating this unifying, you know, section of the population where the legal citizens unite against the illegal immigrant, it creates an us and them. It dismisses a lot of the economic policies that create and us and them between the rich and the poor. We never talk about the rich and the poor. So can you talk a little bit about the social cost, the economic cost of creating a society that's racially divided in this manner?
Well, U.S. society has fundamentally been created in a racial division that were made up by the colonists. Just again, to reinforce what I was saying earlier, it is much easier to scapegoat, if you will, a group of people and racially target them as if they're the cause of any economic problems that we're seeing in the nation, as opposed to the state, when most economists will agree that immigrants, for example, contribute much more in terms of taxes than they take out from the system. Yet this isn't something that's touted around anti-immigrant circles. It's definitely not touted by lawmakers, either on the local or federal level, yet you do have this population, this racialized population, which does contribute much more than they're taking out of the system, if you will, yet this is not how it's seen by large portions of society.
One of the key points that I think this law is making salient, primarily for immigrants, is how the violence against immigrants almost normalizes the violence against citizens, the militarization of citizens. Can you talk a little bit about the connection between the law and the now privatized prison system in the U.S.?
Yes, well, there's actually definitely a connection between the privatizations of prisons and this increased immigrant enforcement. There's actually an excellent investigation by Bo Hodai in These Times, which illustrates how Russell Pierce, which is the man that I mentioned earlier who authored Arizona's SB 1070, first submitted this bill. Before he submitted it to his fellow lawmakers, he submitted the bill to a small nonprofit group called the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC. And ALEC members include not only legislators, but corporations, including the Corrections Corporation of America and the GEO Group, which are the nation's largest and second largest private prison groups. Pierce, of course, says that this bill was only submitted for endorsement. But independent of that, we've also seen private prison groups like the CCA, the Correction Corporation of America, directly lobby the federal government to the tune of more than $4 million in the last 2 years alone, with the explicit goal of increasing their private prison contracts. We've seen the influence of that type of lobbying, which has resulted in increased enforcement. And because ICE, that's U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, because ICE doesn't have sufficient facilities to house these increasingly criminalized brown bodies, they do have to turn those over to these private corporations for profit. However, I do want to add, because I've been myself looking more into and thinking more about these the private prison industrial complex, and I do want to add that we can't use the same equation that we've used in the past in terms of the U.S. Prison industrial complex, because being in the country without papers is actually, it's a civil, it's not a criminal violation, so there is no sentence to be served. Instead, there's a period of detention, and that can be anywhere from a few hours to several months. So from a purely capitalist perspective, private prisons are not the ones that really want to see a total reduction in undocumented immigration, because in the end, they would see very little profit in it. The reasons for anti-immigrant legislation are truly vast. I think that they do include some part of private prison lobbying, but in my opinion, they also have to do with this general sense of xenophobia, which is fueled by the need for the state, and by that I mean the state with a capital S, not just the state of Arizona, but by this need for the state to assert itself during a time of deep crisis, both domestically and abroad.
There's a multiplicity of relationships in terms of how power works in these incidents, how one law not only legitimizes one group of people, but at the same time puts it in contrast to the other. What I see in terms of the social costs, what I call the social costs, is that it also legitimizes abuses against the populations at large. You know, Black Americans, people who have lived in the U.S., have predominantly have been overrepresented in prison systems. So legalizing prisons that are like the ones by Antonio Arpaio, where outdoor tent cities jails are becoming the norm, kind of set a precedent for the kind of impunity and impunity measures that are being imposed on those who are seen as other in society. Can you talk about the social costs for people as a whole, and why do people who see this racist and scapegoating of the economic failures of the market capitalism as the real, you know, driving forces of this, what do we do?
We do bring up some great points, and unfortunately the social costs are, I think, almost too many to name. I will share some of what I think about that. I'll start with the story that I investigated while I was in Arizona living there for 5 months last year. There was a man named David de la Fuente, who was a Mexican national who had lived in Arizona for nearly two decades. He was pulled over when he was driving down the street. The Phoenix police officer who pulled him over decided to do so, according to his own written report, because the driver looked Hispanic and therefore was reasonably suspicious of not possessing a driver's license. The officer, under his own discretion, arrested De La Fuente for producing a fake driver's license. He didn't have to do that under the law. he had a whole bunch of choices of what he could do. He decided to arrest him. Deref Fuente spent about 3 weeks in Sheriff Joe Arpaio's jail, where he contracted pneumonia as a result of being sent back and forth from the jail yard, where the temperatures reached as high as 113 degrees, to a freezing cold interrogation room where he was questioned about his immigration status. He was finally deported about 3 weeks later and then died a few days after that. And according to his doctors, he died as a result of what he endured in prison. He was in the United States and was always sending money back home. So his family is now forced to deal not only with economic peril, but with the fact that their loved one died. And that's one social cost, both in the United States and in Mexico. In Arizona itself, people feel completely terrorized. I, myself, as a Latina, was petrified about being pulled over, regardless of the fact that I'm in the country legally. Children are petrified of what will become of their parents. Adults are scared to send their children to go to school. This kind of self-policing is really horrific. This is another cost, another social cost, which spans generations. And finally, what we've seen in the creation and enforcement of a law which has caused this mass exodus of thousands of people. I'm working now to try to assess the number of brown people who have left Arizona as a result of this law, SB 1070. And the fact that I myself personally, the fact that many of my sources from my time when I was there a year ago have moved to other states is dismaying. The fact that Mexico has opened new sites on that side of the border to keep up with the number of brown people that are leaving Arizona is completely disturbing. And here's why. There is this expected result that brown people who are leaving Arizona in anticipation of this bill and the way that it's being enforced, coupled with current legal practices like 287G and an abhorrent state of racism there, and we've heard it over and we've read it over and over again, brown people will leave, Mexican people are leaving. And we're not talking about people who arrived there yesterday as extra help, but we're talking about people with long ties to this community, people who have worked there, who have paid taxes there, who have bought and sold homes there, who have raised their kids there, who have memories there, and people who are now part of Arizona have been leaving in masses. And so when people talk about deport all of them, we really need to start asking ourselves, well, what does that look like? What would it mean to deport 12 million people? The International Criminal Court in The Hague says that murder, extermination, and enslavement, among others, can constitute crimes against humanity. Deportation or forcible transfer of a population is also on that list. So what does it mean to create a policy which doesn't necessarily deport thousands of people based on their race or ethnicity, but it anticipates that result. It anticipates that there will be a mass exodus of people, of brown people leaving. I think that this is a social cost that no nation should be willing to take at this time.
And I guess the next point for us as a society is, you know, what do people who care about creating societies that are based on egalitarian principles or principles of respect and pluralism, what do we do? How do we transform? How do we change these policies? And how do we create change in our society?
I think the best that we've seen so far, the best that I've seen so far in terms of countering this law, has actually been civil disobedience. We can once again count on everyday people to do the work that we would naturally or unnaturally, rather, assume that the state should be able to do. People in Phoenix, for example, who have already been battling against Sheriff Arpaio, recently chained themselves to the front of his jail in order to halt what he calls a crime sweep, which targets brown people for deportation. And as this legislation spreads, justice and people that are interested in social justice are really going to need to count on creative civil disobedience, because current laws are simply not cutting it.
Thank you so much for joining us. My guest is Aura Bogados. She is an independent writer and a journalist for Set Magazine. Thank you again for joining us. How can people access your writing?
Probably the best way is to Google me. You can find, I post somewhat regularly on Huffington Post, the story which includes this investigation into Joe Arpaio is in this issue of, current issue of Mother Jones Magazine.
Thank you again for being with us.
Thank you, Sylvia.
Take care.
El tiempo es ahora de tenerlos bien puestos. Llegó la hora de enfrentarte con tu oponente. frente. Todo se ve oscuro entre la gente. No busques la salida, piensa en tu movida. Sí, tiempo de desahogarte de esta pinche vida. Buena mano me pusieron en este día de hoy. Lo que tengo, si muero te lo doy. Maneras me hacen falta para lanzarme con mis puños. Un hombre no conoce de rasguños. Dos brazos, dos manos, dos codos y 10 dedos. Reventar toda la madre, sí, eso es lo de menos. Pa' subir arriba hay que ser el ganador. Ni miedo ni conozco de dolor. En este mundo nada sirve,
no.
Siempre hay que estar al brinco, porque unos compas no se animan sin nosotros cinco. Todo en la línea, tienes que representar. Ni modo, te los tienes que agarrar. Para subir arriba no hace falta una escalera. Maneras me hacen falta pa' seguir
para
como
llegar
quiera.
A lo alto
no hace falta un par de alas. El mundo se revela entre las caras.
Para subir arriba
no hace falta una escalera. Maneras me hacen falta pa' seguir
para llegar
a lo alto. No hace falta un par de alas. El mundo se revela entre las caras.
Agárrate bien, traigo peso como un tren. Deshacer el que se cruce, no me importa con quién se me quiera poner al brinco. Aquí estoy, piensas que porque me cruzas voy a parar. ¿Dónde voy? Mi camino es marcado y no me puedes parar. Yo nací para ganar.
Hazte.
Nunca acepto una derrota, me sacudo y me levanto. Cualquier cabrón yo le aguanto. Para lo que yo traigo no hay remedio y nunca lo haberá. Terminará cuando yo muera, lo dudo que sea pronto. Soy duro como el fierro. Atrévete y tu mundo cierro. No creo que desaguante, eres hecho de papel. Te rompo, te arrugo y te tiro como aquel que trató de dominarme y no pudo. Para estas broncas yo no subo.
Para subir arriba no hace falta una escalera. Maneras me hacen falta pa' seguir
para llegar
a lo alto. No hace falta un par de alas. El mundo se revela entre las caras.
Para subir arriba
no hace falta una escalera. Maneras me hacen falta pa' seguir
para llegar
a lo alto. No hace falta un par de alas. El mundo se revela entre las caras.
Cuando está todo en la línea hay que saber representar. Así que no, más de 10 maneras,
sí,
de expresarme por total. Pelón, supernatural,
batallando con las curvas
que la vida me dejó. Peleando con las manos del reloj,
sin querer queriendo,
que
tengo que seguirme riendo. Pisando fuerte para no seguir sufriendo. Sígueme viendo, mira lo que estoy haciendo. Los muros de la vida deshaciendo.
Ya que sientes pura lumbre en la cara y que te lleva la chingada, para otra vez trata de pensarlo dos veces antes de que me ponga yo mis guantes. Hazte de mi cara, no quiero ver lo que te hice. Voltea para el espejo y ahí tú me lo dices. Podrías ver parado y evitado es lo que pasa cuando mi camino es cruzado.
Arriba no hace falta una escalera. Maneras me hacen falta pa' seguir
para llegar
a lo alto. No hace falta un par de alas. El mundo se revela entre las caras.
Para subir arriba
no hace falta una escalera. Maneras me hacen falta pa' seguir
para llegar
a lo alto. No hace falta un par de alas. El mundo se revela entre las caras.
Whether in Canada or United States, when it comes to refugees or so-called illegal immigrants, politicians and the media love to stir up fear and mistruths around these issues. Known as Illegal has defined some of those typical myths in relation to the recent Tamil refugees that arrived on the west coast of Canada. I'm going to read them to you now. Myth 1. They are illegals who are jumping the queue. First of all, there is no queue for refugee claimants. Refugees are forced from their homes in emergency situations due to human rights abuses committed during wars, military occupations, or persecution against a minority group. We cannot expect refugees to wait for Canada to select them from overseas. We must understand that they undertake long and dangerous journeys to protect their lives and the lives of their families, according to the 1951 UN Convention on Refugees, to which Canada is a party. There are no penalties on refugees who arrive without pre-authorization. Myth 2. They are terrorists. There is no evidence to substantiate this. Furthermore, officials are just relying on stereotypes of Tamils as all being associated with the Tamil Tigers to create unnecessary racist hysteria and mistrust of asylum seekers. National security laws in the post-9/11 climate have directly targeted and marginalized immigrants, refugees, and racialized people. These laws and policies are less about protecting society than creating a culture of fear. Many of these policies, such as security certificates, have been struck down in the courts after years of human rights and anti-racist campaigning. The rhetoric of war on terror serves as a convenient distraction from the reality that people's daily lives are increasingly unsafe and insecure due to global neoliberal economics and warmongering that leads to mass displacement, poverty, and human rights atrocities. Myth 3. The situation is getting better in Sri Lanka. According to 2010 Amnesty International report, in the past 12 months, the Sri Lankan government has continued to jail critics and clamp down on dissent. Some 80,000 Tamils remain in refugee camps, while 400,000 displaced Tamils survive in communities where homes and infrastructure were destroyed. The government continues to extend a state of emergency, restricting many basic human rights, and thousands of arbitrary detentions are justified under the guise of detainees being suspected Tamil tigers. This past month, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon appointed a panel to investigate war crimes and genocidal acts committed by the Sri Lankan government against Tamils. Myth 4. They are a burden on taxpayers. The biggest resource expenditure has been the government's choice to spend thousands of dollars on unnecessary security operations, including resources spent on incarcerating women and children. Only a tiny fraction has been spent on the health and well-being of the migrants. Those lives are worth more than dollars. Furthermore, scapegoating migrants and being a financial burden lets the government off the hook. All residents continue to receive inadequate access to necessary social services because of misplaced government priorities. Myth 5. Canada has a generous refugee system. We cannot keep accepting people. Despite the border panics, only a small minority of asylum seekers make its claims in the Western world. There are about 20 million refugees worldwide, and most migrate into neighboring countries of Africa, Middle East, and South Asia. Canada accepts fewer than 20,000 refugees per year. That's less than 0.1% of the world's displaced population. Furthermore, Canada's system is not generous. Deportations from Canada have skyrocketed 50% over the last decade, with 13,000 deportations in the past year. With the Conservatives, the number of approved asylum claims has dropped by 56%. Minister of Immigration Jason Kenney's recent refugee reforms create two tiers of refugees, establishing a hierarchy based on nationality. There are countless structural flaws in the system designed to make it near impossible to claim asylum. Immigration and refugee board members are political appointees. Certain avenues, such as the pre-removal risk assessment, have acceptance rates of 3-5%, while others, such as the humanitarian compassionate claim, do not have to be processed prior to deportation. In addition, the refugee system has been termed a lottery system because acceptance rates can vary from 0 to 80% depending on the judge. The Safe Third Country Agreement between the U.S. and Canada creates a fortress Canada by disallowing up to 40% of asylum seekers. Myth 6. This is not our problem. The Canadian government has recently been forced to apologize for racist and exclusionary historical measures, including the Chinese Exclusion Act and Komagata-Maru incident. These apologies and the rhetoric of multiculturalism is hollow when current policies and practices perpetuate racism and exclusion. The recent backlash that repeals the tired old refrain about illegals and criminals has meant right-wing politicians such as Paul Fromm and Ariane Garde have resurfaced publicly and are being given a platform to spew their hate about sending the boat back. Is this really the side that we are on? Immigration and refugee issues are not simply about Canadian benevolence or charity. We need to rethink what function and whose interest the state border actually serves. The current trends of global migration reveal the ways in which patterns of Western domination and corporate globalization have enriched some countries by creating economic and political insecurity that forces people indigenous to their lands to migrate. The Canadian government continues to maintain economic and diplomatic ties with the government of Sri Lanka, instead of supporting those who have survived the brutality of that government, which makes us complicit in their displacement. Also, we must always remember that Canada is a settler country, built on the theft of indigenous lands and the forced assimilation of indigenous communities. On what basis is a colonial government denying colonized people their right to livelihood? Finally, we must challenge the idea that some are more worthy than others to a life of dignity. Instead, we should reframe the universal value that people have the freedom to move in order to seek safety and flourish. These refugees have the right to stay here. No human is illegal. You are listening to Latin Waves, a weekly syndicated program. For more information about our program, visit www.latinwavesmedia.com. Latin Waves Media is also now available on Twitter at Twitter/LatinWavesMedia.